Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Every so often here on the podcast, we like to step outside the boundaries of traditional academia and talk with folks who interact with the religious landscape on a daily basis in a number of different roles. I do this in the firm belief that academic scholars do not have a monopoly on knowledge, and that actually everybody has lots and lots of interesting things to say and contribute to our understanding of this world. I find these interviews to be some of the most interesting and intriguing ones that I do, and today's discussion should be no different because we dip into the world of religious fashion. A few weeks ago, on my Twitter feed, I saw an interesting article reviewing a Christian fashion show. Now, I didn't even know such a thing existed, which tells you how unfashionable I am. So, to rectify my cultural blind spot, I contacted the author of that article, who happens to write a great deal about Christianity and fashion as a journalist. That person, and our guest today, is Whitney Bauck, an artist and writer who notes that she is passionate about engaging fashion in a way that doesn't embarrass God or thinking people. She is the creator of the fashion theology blog Unwrinkling, which has caught the attention of none other than the New York Times. Whitney does both freelance writing and photography and has published in various outlets, including the Washington Post and Christianity Today. She grew up in the Philippines, went to school outside of Chicago, and currently resides in one of the most fashionable towns on the planet, New York City, which ranks second only to Duval, Washington, the real trendsetting capital of the world. We will have links to Whitney's blog Unwrinkling on our website, and I urge you to venture over there because it really has some fun and interesting stuff. Whitney, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much.
Hey, before we dive into the world of religion and fashion, I want to get to know a little bit about you, since you seem to have lived and are still living a very interesting life where you get to chase your own passions and you're very successful in doing so. So tell us a little bit about you growing up in Manila and how you eventually ended up writing about religion and fashion.
Yeah, so I moved to Manila, Philippines, with my parents when I turned about 3 years old, and they were moving there as missionaries. So I grew up in a really international community just outside the city, and had a lot of, as a result, had a lot of really diverse influences in how I was thinking about clothing, which was just a lot of fun because we had, one of my best friends was Filipino, and one of my best friends was Norwegian, and one of my best friends was Korean, and so we would, you know, go back to our respective countries for the summer or for Christmas break and then come back and have all these different things influencing us. So I feel like I got kind of a fun take, even as a really young person, on international fashion, and really loved clothing and loved fashion for a long time. But because I was in a community where all of the adults that I knew were in the nonprofit or NGO world, I was aware of real need in a very real way. And poverty is in your face all the time in Manila, and there's just a lot of things like that that you can't really escape from. So I thought, you know, I want to do work that matters. I don't want to be involved in fashion. And it's actually taken kind of a long journey for me to get to the place of, A, realizing that fashion is really important, and B, that I can be involved in that as a person of faith.
I have to ask about growing up as a missionary kid. I didn't do that. I have a number of friends who did, and that must be a very interesting life, and especially if you're interested in fashion. You know, your parents are out there preaching and doing Bible stuff, and you're thinking about fashion stuff. Do they ever turn to you and say, hey, you're supposed to be doing the missionary stuff, not the fashion stuff?
My parents are always really supportive of me, but I definitely think they didn't always understand my clothing choices. So we had conversations about that, to be sure. And I went to a little missionary kid school, so there was a dress code, and definitely butted up against that in different ways, shapes, and forms, just because, you know, they're trying to cater to a community that's super diverse across denominations, super diverse across nationalities and ethnicities, and trying to find sort of middle ground that everyone can feel comfortable with. So those are some of the clashes that came up.
Yeah, as a father of a teenager right now, I can tell you that all that stuff comes up with clothing, because I, you know, I look at my kid and says, "You got to be kidding! What are you going out of the house looking like that?" And you know, I remember my parents saying that too. And it must have been interesting going to a school that had a dress code, because you know you're not supposed to think about fashion; you're supposed to be thinking about schooling. And so, was there a little bit of a rebellion in there that kind of pushed you down the fashion route? You're saying, "Hey, everybody's wearing the same clothes. I wonder what the world would look like if everybody had different clothes."
Growing up, I was actually very not rebellious. Like, I was very much the kind of goody two-shoes, if anything. I really, really liked getting the approval of people, like, of the people in authority over me. So I really don't think I was motivated very often by wanting to push boundaries in that way. But I really did love clothing, and I also loved art and, you know, have been sort of making art pretty actively since I was in middle school. And I guess I can see how the things are tied together, in that clothing is the most intimate form of visual culture. So, and it's something that you can experiment with as a really young person, because, you know, like, I discovered thrift stores as a sixth grader, and suddenly my measly allowance could actually afford fun and funky clothes that weren't the same as everyone else around me. So I think as I've gotten older, there's maybe more rebellion now, but actually as a teen, that wasn't really my MO at the time.
Interesting. So how do you get from being a teen as the daughter of a missionary parents in the Philippines to being a freelance journalist that is now in New York City? It was by way of Chicago too, education there, right?
Yeah. So like I said, I really wanted to contribute to the world in a meaningful way that I saw as doing kingdom work, to put it that way. And so I went to Wheaton College, outside of Chicago in Illinois, and I was studying art there, and again, hadn't really been thinking about fashion. I still loved clothes and was definitely connecting with other students over that, but it wasn't where I found myself going. And it basically came to the point where I got a job doing jewelry sales as a direct salesperson that I was actually really terrible at. But in the context of that job, started thinking about fashion again and really felt like this is something that I've dismissed and said can't really be done by people of faith, can't really be done by people who are deep, essentially, or care about real things. But it's something I haven't examined since I was really, really young. So I started trying to find resources of, like, who could help me think about this in a Christian way. So I started combing the libraries and looking online and trying to find anything I possibly could to have a sort of develop a theology of fashion to understand how it should be thought about, and was surprised to really come up blank. Like, there was very, very little out there. There wasn't very many people writing about it or talking about it. The few people that I could find on the internet, actually one of them was someone here in New York City, and another was someone in California, and I'm this random undergrad writing them from the suburbs of Illinois, but they were all basically telling me, like, this is something we've come to the conclusion that we can do and that we're doing in God's favor, but we came to these conclusions in the context of our own church communities, and there's no books we can point you to. There's no articles, you know, this is something you have to figure out yourself. So I went back to school that year, and I wrote a paper for my art history class that probably my professor shouldn't have let me write, because it wasn't super relevant to the assignment, but I think he knew I needed to write it, and I basically just looked at everything that the Bible says about clothing, adornment, jewelry, nakedness, anything that was in any way related to clothing. And at the end of that paper, I came out thinking, this is so important. This is important to God. This is important to the God of the universe. I can't ignore it.
Yeah, I mean, the way we present ourselves to others, I mean, we're all God's children, and the way we interact with one another is, we think about it in behavioral ways and that, but it's also, we present ourselves with our clothing, with the way we adorn ourselves every day. I think that's really interesting. I have to be surprised that you were surprised that there was nothing on the internet about religion and fashion, because I would have thought I'd go out there and Google it up and nothing would come up. I mean, that would be my anticipation. So I don't think I would have been surprised. But it's really neat that you're able to find this niche and to really carve it out for yourself. And you end up writing this blog called Unwrinkling. Tell us a little bit about the blog, including how it got the name Unwrinkling.
Yeah, so basically the semester after I wrote that paper that I was talking about, I was starting to think, I think this is I think all of this fashion stuff and fashion as it relates to faith specifically and the Christian faith, I think there's a lot there and there's a lot that could be plumbed. And the more I was thinking about it, the more I was thinking I need some accountability. So to keep diving into this myself. So I started the blog sort of as a form of accountability so that I would be digging into it, but then also hopefully I was thinking, you know, in the long run, maybe I'll be able to create resources that would help other people so that if some other, you know, 19-year-old is Googling on the internet and trying to find something, maybe they, you know, I could provide resources that would help them start thinking about these things. So that's how Unwrinkling got started. And the name came from wanting something that would be memorable and clearly related to clothing and also indicative of something with a little more depth, because I knew it wasn't going to be a blog that was just me posting outfits that I had worn that day. Not that I have anything against some of those kinds of blogs, and I think, I mean, I follow some of those people, and I think they're really fun, but it just wasn't what I was trying to do. So I thought about Unwrinkling, and I like that Unwrinkling is both something that is in some ways deconstructing, like you're taking something apart or you're flattening something out, you're removing something that already exists, but it's with the purpose of sort of reconstructing something in the end. So when you're taking wrinkles out of a shirt, you're removing something, but it's with the hope that you're actually going to make the shirt more wearable in the long run. And that's sort of how I would like to think about my approach to fashion and the fashion industry and fashion theory, in that it requires a lot of critique and deconstruction, because there is a lot that's really troubling in the fashion industry, but it's not in the hope to dismantle this whole industry. It's actually out of a love for clothing and a belief that clothing is actually a really powerful part of our lives.
And you do that very successfully. This is a really neat blog, and I know many people think, oh, a fashion blog, it's going to just be runway pictures and stuff like that. But it really does go into a lot of depth about different things, that some of which we'll be talking about, including from, you know, styles and trends that are happening to the industry itself, that how are the clothes produced? Where are they produced? What are the conditions under which they're produced? And so it is a really neat resource. And I'm not somebody who puts a lot into fashion, but I found it really kind of interesting to think about the dimensions of the fashion world. And so I applaud you for your efforts there, and hopefully many people will go out there and check it out. The one other thing, other than just the blog, you mentioned that you're an artist. You're a freelance journalist, and we're going to talk about one of the articles that you wrote, actually several of the ones that you wrote. But you also mentioned that you're an artist. And for me, you know, again, I'm not a really artistic person. So when somebody says they're an artist, I think, well, they're a painter, you know, or somebody like Van Gogh or somebody like that. But what kind of artistry do you do? Because there is a pretty broad range of what constitutes art out there.
Yeah. So I guess my, probably about 5 years ago, the main part of my practice would have been, it would have actually included painting. So painting and multimedia collages was what I was doing at the time. And then for about the last 4 or 5 years, I've been focusing really heavily on photography and fine art photography specifically. So I just have found it a useful medium for communicating ideas. And one of my favorite poets, Christian Wiman, talks about art as something that often does theology better than theology does. So I think, not just with theology, but with many aspects of life, I think art can be a really useful way of working things out and trying to understand what you think or how the world works or whatever the case may be, in ways that just straightforward discourse can't.
That's a great observation, because we do think of theology as something that just goes on in seminaries and, you know, deep, dark, dank library that's all musty, filled with books and a lot of interesting or people thinking interesting thoughts and that. But really, it goes on every day in our daily lives, and we express it in so many different ways. So that is really cool. That's a really cool idea. Well, I want to talk about the world of religious fashion, or fashion and religion, and use your article that you wrote in Christianity Today as a launching point. And it came out in Christianity Today in August. We'll link to it on our website. And it was about your review of Christian Fashion Week. And the article was entitled, "Why Fashion Matters: How Christian Fashion Week Could Spur the Church to Engage Clothing Simply Beyond Buying It." And that, again, was one of these things that, you know, appears on their Christian Fashion Week. Huh? Who thought of this? What is Christian Fashion Week? Who created this? How long has it been going on?
Yeah, well, that was pretty similar to my response when I first heard of it. Christian Fashion Week So 2015 was Christian Fashion Week's third year, pretty young little institution. It was started by two couples in Tampa, Florida, and that's also where it's held. And they had had various different experiences in the fashion industry themselves, so they decided to start Christian Fashion Week as a way to show the world their vision of what it looked like to be Christians, to look at fashion with a Christian worldview, I think is how they would put it.
Okay, so what goes on in the thing? It's first of all, it's held in Tampa, which is interesting because you don't think of Tampa as being a center of the world of fashion. You think of it as, you know, Mickey Mouse ears and Disney. Or I guess that's Orlando. I mean, Florida's all the same.
Somewhere around there, right?
So, what goes on in one of these things? Is it just a bunch of runways? Actually, it's a week too. I think it was 5 days.
Yeah, so it's a little bit different from, like one of the bigger fashion weeks like New York or London or Milan, in that there are events happening, but there's really actually only one runway show. So, or one sort of portion that's all runway show. So the 4 days leading up to the big sort of showcase were various smaller events. So the first day that I was there, there was a small panel talking about modesty, and that was probably less than 50 people, you know, sitting around in a room talking. And then another day there was a like styling expert who was there talking about different styling things, and then there was shopping opportunities. And then Friday was the last day, and that was the big showcase where they actually had, you know, designers showcasing their work coming down the runway, etc.
And you say that's a little bit different than New York Fashion Weeks, and you've been to some of these as well. I mean, I've never been to one, and the only time I ever see these things might be on the news or some clip on some TV show, and I just think it's people walking back and forth on some boards showing off some clothes. But do other fashion shows do the same thing with little seminars about this is what we're thinking about and blah blah blah?
Not really. So like New York Fashion Week just happened here in New York a few weeks ago, and basically it's literally a week of shows. So different designers from, you know, all over, where you show as a designer depends on where you are regionally. So there are brands that will show only in Milan. There are brands that will show only in New York. But basically fashion professionals from all over the world will fly to whatever city it is and then go to these shows to see the next season's collections. And then at night there's big parties that often involve a lot of celebrities and networking events for these different fashion professionals.
So the New York shows, Milan and Paris, I assume, bring in all the big wigs, the celebrities that want to be seen and be heard. But down there in Tampa, who's attending this show?
Yeah, Tampa was a lot more local. I would definitely say that. So the way, it's kind of funny how my relationship with Christian Fashion Week actually started, because I found out they exist on the internet and basically wrote a critique of them on my blog. And then as a result of that, one of the founders reached out to me and we started having an open dialogue on my blog.
Oh, wait, tell us about this. So you found them on the internet. You must have been typing in Christian and fashion and week. Pops up, right? There it is. And you write a critique about it. What did you critique? What are you talking about, you silly Christians in fashion? What was the basis of the critique?
Well, so I actually, like you, I saw something about it on Twitter, and I just sort of was cringing, because I guess the first part to me was, what do you even mean, Christian Fashion Week? I mean, to have something that is called Christian Fashion Week implies that something like New York Fashion Week is inherently antithetical to Christianity, which, just as a premise, I was really interested in that and why they would conclude that. And then once I started looking at them and looking at, you know, what I was finding online about them, it was, their entire platform was modesty, which modesty is something that we see talked about in the Bible, but it's tiny, like compared to what the Bible says overall about clothing, the bits about modesty are such a small percentage. So to me, seeing a group of people saying this is a Christian perspective on fashion and then have them only talk about modesty, not really define what modesty meant, and totally ignore a bunch of other issues that are really prevalent in the Bible, such as like ethical labor standards and like environmental ethics and, you know, some other things like that, that to me are really important. I just thought, don't say that you're representing a Christian view on fashion. Like, you can have, it's great to, you know, have your own fashion week or have something different or even have a modesty-centered fashion week. But to sort of reduce the Christian vision on fashion to modesty seemed really oversimplifying to me.
Okay, so you make that critique, and I can see where you would make that critique, and I want to talk a little bit about the modesty angle here in a second, but you mentioned that the founders of this show saw the critique, and they reached out to you, and you started a dialogue. What was that like?
It was really incredible. I wasn't writing a critique expecting them to respond. I didn't know them. I was just sort of writing it for my own small readership and saying, you know, these are my thoughts about this thing. But I was really impressed with Jose Gomez, who is the one who wrote me, and his willingness to have a conversation just because, you know, he found me, he wrote me, and some members of their community weren't necessarily always gracious. I think some people felt a little defensive of their founders, which I think speaks to how well-loved they are, which was also kind of cool to see in that sense. But Jose was incredibly gracious. He was very, very willing to have conversation, very willing to hear from me what I thought the problems were and why it wasn't something that I would necessarily get behind. And actually, over the course of our dialogue, they changed part of their platform for the next year. So that showed me that they were really serious about what they said in terms of being open to really try to present a Christian worldview rather than just, you know, sort of coming up with their own thing and then calling it good. They actually wanted to have conversations with other Christians who cared.
That must have felt really cool that they changed their platform and incorporated some of your ideas and critiques into their next session. Because usually you just, you know, complain about stuff on the internet and it goes into this, you know, big cloud in the sky that nobody ever pays attention to. But you got results. That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was exciting.
Okay, so that's very cool. I want to ask about some of the additional things that went into it, because some of the things that you mentioned about labor standards, environmental ethics, plays into your writing as well. But here's the question I'm dying to ask, and this is, I think, the question that any typical layperson would ask when they heard Christian Fashion Week. Again, you're thinking runways, and what are the fashion styles there? Is this, I mean, I heard this, I go, this is going to be a runway show with dresses from Little House on the Prairie, right? This, it'd be modesty stuff, right? So modesty is a big thing, right? Do they package that, or does it get a little bit more funky and wacky?
So this past year, they weren't actually, didn't have some of the regulations in place, I think, that they necessarily did before, but there's a pretty big range. I mean, in terms of everything from the kinds of styles to I would say the, you know, the quality of designs. There are some people who, there are multiple designers who have debuted their first collection at Christian Fashion Week. So we're talking amateurs here. I mean, they haven't necessarily done this before. And then there's others that are phenomenal. I mean, I was talking with the journalist there for the New York Times, and she was saying, you know, some of this stuff you could put on the runway at New York Fashion Week and no one would know the difference. So some of my favorites were, There was a designer who had a lot of like black lace and leather that showed up, and it was these like long gowns that I just thought was really, really beautiful. And then there was other stuff that I wasn't necessarily crazy about, but there's a huge range for sure.
Yeah, I could imagine that. You know, I think Christian fashion, you go into a Christian bookstore and you got the sequined, you know, big cross on a T-shirt or something like that. And I'm sure there's some of that, but other things there as well, huh?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And, I mean, there are, again, there's a huge range of, even, so like you said, there are some, you know, T-shirts there, and then there's another designer who's actually really young and sort of was discovered by Christian Fashion Week, who makes these couture gowns out of, like, hand-collected feathers, that she makes these gorgeous, gorgeous feather dresses. So there's a massive range of what's available there.
So that issue of modesty, it comes up, and I know in our discussions, email discussions, and setting up this interview, you were like, oh, do I have to talk about modesty again? Because that's all the Christians end up talking about. But it is something that does come up, and if we could just briefly touch upon it. The issue of modesty comes up in the Bible, as you noted in your Christianity Today article in both 1 Timothy 2:9 and in James 2, to not be ostentatious and that. So how does this all play into Christian Fashion Week, but more so the Christian mindset when it comes to fashion?
Yeah, there's a lot that we could talk about there. I think that what I often go to immediately is wanting to sort of deconstruct a lot of Christian modesty rhetoric because I think it's pretty problematic. So there's a number of different things that we could talk through, but I mean, first of all, it's a hard thing to define. So I grew up in a community that talked about modesty, especially to young women, a lot. And it was well defined in the sense of we're calling this modest and this immodest, but there wasn't very much conversation given around context about how different things are considered modest in one culture and highly immodest in another culture. I think one of the other problems is that it's something that's disproportionately aimed at women. And I would say that's come about because of the way that we have sexualized women's bodies over and above men's bodies. So it gets to the point where the female body is seen as primarily a sexual object, or a reproductive object, but not really much else. And I think that's also really problematic. And putting all the onus for modesty or for sort of sexual spin on women based on how they dress contributes to rape culture in a lot of ways that I'm not comfortable with. So there's just a lot of things about how these things, especially are communicated to young people, like you're saying, your teenager, mm-hmm. That I think we could do better in.
Yeah, my teenager is mostly not being able to match his socks to his shorts. So that's the problem I have. He's a pretty good kid. So, but one of the things that came up in this Christian Fashion Week when discussing that is something known as the CARE model, C-A-R-E. And it talked about contextual modesty, affordable, sustainable fashion, responsible use of natural resources, and ethical hiring. Tell us a little bit about that and what were people thinking in terms of the approach to a Christian worldview in the world of clothing and fashion.
Yeah, so I'm really grateful to see that model being incorporated. And as I mentioned, you know, some of those sort of tenets came directly out of the conversations Jose and I were having. So I would say there's so many things that you can talk about when you talk about what the Bible says about clothing. But to me, some of the almost low-hanging fruit of things that I feel like should be really obvious are we see God putting out pretty clearly how people are to treat the foreigner and the poor and the oppressed. And so often, those are the people that are making our garments if we're Western consumers. So, name almost any major clothing retailer, and I can almost guarantee you, unless there are a select few who are really intentional about it, their labor practices are probably pretty horrendous. So we produce a lot of things in factories that are really unsafe, and people aren't compensated adequately for it, and children end up there, and you know, there are problematic conditions happening in a lot of ways. But in 2013, we sort of saw the natural outcome of this, which is in Bangladesh, there was a huge factory fire that killed over 1,000 people, and it was a factory that was directly producing a bunch of garments for companies in the UK and the US. And I think for a lot of people in the industry, I would like to think it served as a wake-up call to some degree, but I guess that's one part of it, of saying we really need to, if we're going to say that we're Christians and we're talking about clothing, we really need to talk about how we're treating our laborers. So that's one part. Another part that is, and there is the sort of sustainability and environmental ethics part of it, and that's another thing that I've been pretty passionate about for a while. So the textile industry is the number one polluter of the planet, which is kind of shocking to me. So there's everything from fabric waste that's, you know, on the edge of a big roll of fabric as you're cutting the clothes, to the way that dyes are disposed of. A lot of them end up in our waterways, especially in places like China. So trying to figure out how to get around those things in the production process, and then on the other side, that's sort of the businesses and how they need to look at it. And then on the other side, there's the consumer aspect. So when we're buying really cheap clothes that, you know, maybe we wear for a little bit of time and then they either fall apart or we don't like them anymore because they're not in, a lot of those clothing items end up in landfills. And that ends up being another huge, huge source of pollution. So talking about how things are being produced and then how sort of durable they are, or their ability to last through the fashion cycle, is another part of talking about environmental sustainability in clothing.
Yeah, and this gets you this gets to what you were talking about before about fashion theology. It's not just the way the clothes look, but it's about the whole process from design to production to consumption of it, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one of the nice things you do on your website is to talk about some of the stories of successful incorporation of Christian ethics into the production design of these clothes. Tell us some of those. I mean, you tell us stories about Secco Designs. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. And then also the Akola Project. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, so Secco Designs and the Akola Project are two fashion-based social enterprises that I've become aware of and become a fan of in the last few years. I have a pretty intimate knowledge of Secco Designs at this point because I had a unique opportunity this summer to spend 6 weeks half sort of working for them and half sort of spying on them and learning about how they do business. So there's a bunch of small companies like this that are popping up and saying, not only do we want to do no harm in the way that we're making clothing, we actually want to go further and have a positive impact. So part of how Secco does that, they make women's accessories and footwear, and they produce in East Africa. And they're working specifically with high-achieving young women from impoverished backgrounds. So there'll be these women who graduate from high school with really high marks, have gotten accepted to college, but then they have this 9-month gap in Uganda where you're supposed to basically go try to make enough money to go to college because you have to pay everything up front. And if they can't find work in that time period, they usually won't end up going to college. So Liz Bohannon, who is part of the founding team of Secco Design, she saw this problem while she was in Uganda, and she thought, you know, we can help fill this gap. So she basically started this company as a way for women to be working there for this 9-month period to both help them with wages and also giving them sort of the equipment to start being ready for college and doing some college prep things. Akola Project is similar in that it's working with women in Uganda, but it's in some ways more comprehensive programming. So Akola Project is actually a nonprofit. They sell jewelry in the U.S. It's really high-quality jewelry. And then they have a huge host of different programs they do with the women, everything from education to healthcare to like spiritual formation as they're trying to sort of help these women from these impoverished backgrounds. So those are just two companies among dozens and dozens and dozens that are starting to crop up here and there. And it's hard in some ways for these companies because they're going up against the big guys and the people who are, you know, charging you $3 for a shirt, which you can't make ethically. You can't make a $3 t-shirt ethically. It's just not possible. But I think especially as younger generations are starting to put more of an emphasis on ethical production, I'm hoping to see more companies like this thrive.
And so for both of those, Secco and the Akola Project, are both those run by Christian leaders, or is it they're just ethical and so it kind of seems Christian?
They are. They actually both happen to be run by Christians. There are also other brands that I'm a huge fan of and that are doing things really well. That aren't run by Christians, but it has been a cool trend to sort of see young, especially like 20 to 30-year-old Christians seeing, this is a way that I can live out my faith incarnationally and take the gospel and really not just, you know, have it as something that I'm giving mental assent to, but I can really find a way to live out. And so I feel like there's actually a pretty large number of these little companies that are run by Christians, which is very cool.
Let me ask you a tough question here. In my profession, I happen to be a political economist, and so we look at labor practices across countries sometimes. And I see on campus all the time, there's protests against sweatshop labor that comes up, and there's, you know, boycott this brand or that brand because they're producing sweatshop jerseys in Pakistan or whatever it might be. And one of the things as an economist, I'm always kind of worried about that kind of boycott is that if you do boycott that, you might be taking away opportunities from individuals, and that the other option that they have might be even worse. So, yeah, sweatshop labor, that really sucks, especially that one in Bangladesh. They had the doors locked when the fire broke out. That was horrible, right? And that world really does suck. But on the other hand, we oftentimes in economics ask people, well, what's the alternative? What are the opportunity costs there? If these people lose jobs in sweatshops, they might be going to something even worse, such as, you know, picking in garbage dumps to survive on a daily basis, working in farms and risking getting tapeworms and things like that, and possibly even going into, you know, sexual prostitution or even horrible things like that. So how would you respond, you know, and thinking about these, because you do think about this stuff a lot on your blog and I'm sure in your daily life, how would you respond to something like that?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up because it is complex, right? People want an easy answer, and we want something that, you know, I can do this one thing and then I can feel good about myself that I did the right thing and then I don't really have to engage it anymore. And there's not that simple of an answer, but I guess often when people bring up that critique to me, and I wouldn't assume this of you because you seem like a very thoughtful person, but often it feels to me like it's an excuse for people to not change their habits. Because I think that it's one thing if you're saying, yes, like, I'm going to keep shopping at X, Y, and Z store because I don't want to completely take away jobs for these people. But if you're doing that and not doing anything to sort of try to reach out to the company or to try, you know, do something to be proactive to see those policies changed, then I'm just not that convinced that it's coming from a place of genuinely caring about those people. The other thing that I would say about boycotting is that in the short term, for sure, if Western consumers are just saying, you know, bring everything back to American factories or, you know, whatever the hot thing is at the time, sure, in the moment, that takes away jobs for those people. But what I really do believe is that if there are more and more and more people who care about this and say, we're not going to buy from places that are producing things poorly and that are, you know, using child labor and that are letting people die in factories, but eventually these big corporations will change and it will still be cheaper to produce in Bangladesh than it is to produce in Kentucky. But if you can keep people safe in Bangladesh at a cheaper price than you can in Kentucky. So it doesn't have to mean that these people aren't having jobs. It just has to mean, please take care of them better. And that's why I think it's cool that you brought up like a Cola or Seiko, because those are the alternatives. I mean, those are companies that are saying, we're still going to produce in these countries that where we can do things more cheaply. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they just took a U.S. Factory model and then dropped it in Uganda. I mean, they have realistic understandings, like they're not necessarily paying people American wages. And, you know, to some American consumers would say, well, that's, you know, they're just exploiting them too. And they're saying, no, like we are giving opportunities to these people. We're also still being competitive in the market. But we're saying we're not just going to say the fact that we're giving you a job is enough. Like, get over the rest of it. We're saying, like, no, we're going to have safe places for you to work, and we are going to pay you fairly for your country wage and usually above and beyond that, and you can still be profitable in the U.S. So I think it's complex, but I think there are alternatives. And boycotting actually has worked at times. So Nike is a really notorious human rights violator in their production over the years. And I would actually say that they are still, in many ways, not where I would like to see them, but there was a period in the 90s where they started getting really bad press for some of their factory conditions, and it was so bad and sort of new at the time that people really stopped buying them, and as a result, like, Nike changed their policies. So that was an example of a time when this massive, massive corporation, and it sort of seemed like, you know, nothing you can do is going to change them, really had to change because consumer demand said, you know, we're voting with our dollars and we're voting you down unless you change.
Yeah, and I can see how that works. And you've written on this on your blog, too, about being a smart consumer and thinking about ethical consumerism. Because, again, we will often push the issues off to the producer of these things, say, hey, you better take care of these folks. But you have a really nice, interesting article on your Unwrinkling blog that talks about, well, you know, production is a function of consumption. And so you have to think about the ways that you make purchases because that affects the production. And you talk about the 7 steps of ethical consumerism. Walk us through some of those steps.
Yeah. So, I mean, as soon as I started blogging, it became very clear to me that I was going to have to practice what I preached or I was going to have to stop preaching it.
Yeah.
So I've become increasingly interested in what does it actually take to be a person who has to buy things sometimes and to do that well. So again, this isn't like a fail-safe way of doing things, but I would say the first thing is just to do your homework. We live in the information age, and sometimes that can be overwhelming, and it seems like there's so much out there, but it's really not impossible to find resources that will help you gauge sort of how a company is going about their production. So two of the websites that I use are like freetowork.org or ethicalconsumer.org, but there's plenty of others that can sort of help you figure out, you know, how are these people treating their animals, how are they treating their laborers, et cetera. The second thing is sort of referencing what I said before of thinking of your purchases as a voter's ballot. So every time you spend money, you're essentially voting, and you're telling the economy, you're telling the specific company, like, this is what I will support and this is what I won't. And that kind of goes back to doing your homework again. Like, hopefully you're not going to head to the voting polls without knowing a single thing about the candidate that is on the ballot. In the same way, I would hope you wouldn't walk into a clothing store knowing absolutely nothing about who has or hasn't been harmed in the process of making the clothes that are going to be in that store. Another really easy thing to do, and this is sort of where I default in, what I default into a lot when I can't do all the research ahead of time, is just to buy secondhand. That way you only have to trace back your money one step rather than going, okay, you know, I got this in a department store, and I have to research the specific brand, and where did the brand make the garment, and where did the textile come from. You can just go back one step, because that's the only person directly getting money from you. So, you know, if you know that Salvation Army is a charity that you feel comfortable supporting, you can shop there and feel comfortable supporting it. I'm still, in that sense, I'm still careful about branding, because I don't want to serve as a walking billboard for companies that I don't support. So I still won't buy, like, take on Nike again, Nike secondhand, just because I don't want to advertise for them on my body. But other than that, secondhand purchases are generally pretty safe. And then another thing that people often overlook is you can engage these companies directly. The social media that is out there, it's surprising how close you are actually getting to some of the higher ups. So if you're tweeting at people, you're trying to talk to them on Facebook, or you're writing blog posts about it, or using whatever ways you can to sort of get in touch with them, let them know. Let them know what you think. Say, you know, I love the designs of your clothing, but I can't support the way that you have, you know, been dumping these chemicals in this waterway. If enough people do that, these companies will listen. And you can tell others about that too. You can help raise awareness amongst your own communities. And then one hard thing, I think, for Western consumers especially is the idea of being willing to adjust our habits. I think even the idea of this article that we're sort of talking through right now, which is like steps towards ethical consumerism, that very premise has to be questioned on some level, right? Like, is ethical consumerism really possible? And I don't think there's a super clear-cut answer to that, but I think part of it is, even if you, you know, do all the other things, there might just be some level on which you have to say, I can't have all that I want. I can't, you know, maybe I think I should have the right to, you know, a pair of blue jeans and a pair of black jeans and this kind of pant and this kind of pant. And maybe I just have to say, you know what, if I can't find this pair of jeans that's in my size that I can purchase ethically, I just don't get to have it, or I don't get to have it for a while, which is so simple, but really, really hard for us to do because we don't have a mindset that allows for that. But I think with time, we can get there and saying, like, yeah, I don't have to look like everyone around me in terms of how I'm thinking about my closet. And the last little bit of advice that I would say is just to choose hope. I think a lot of times when I have conversations with people about this, they can feel really overwhelmed and like, I don't have the time, or I don't have the energy to do the research, or, you know, what is, you know, one little person like me going to be able to do against these massive giant companies in the long run. But I would say, especially if you're a person of faith, if you're a Christian, like, you are called to fight the long defeat, to use Paul Farmer's words, of you're in this thing that you know is hard, and that in some ways it's going to look like you're losing, and it might look like you've lost in your lifetime, but you're called to do the hard right thing. And I think when we all choose that together, we really can make positive change.
Let me ask about this in terms of, you're fairly young. You'd be part of the millennial generation, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and something that has come up in the media in recent years and also in social science circles has been the increase of nuns, people who are drifting away from the church. And this this drifting toward no religion doesn't mean anti-religion, but it means I'm just not affiliated with a denomination or not going to church, is pronounced mostly amongst the millennials. And as I listen to you talk, I'm wondering to what extent the millennial generation can reconnect with their religion, with faith, through these the way that you're engaging it, you know, not the traditional everybody shows up at Sunday and their Sunday best and we do the, you know, stale coffee and donuts and that kind of thing. What's your thoughts upon the millennial generation and faith, since you're living in that community essentially?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways that's a huge can of worms that we could talk about for another few hours, but I feel like my own faith has changed so much in the last 1 year, in the last 5 years, that I don't know what 18-year-old Whitney would say about, you know, Whitney in 2015. I think in some ways my faith looks so different that it's almost hard to call them by the same name, and yet I know this is just the process of life. And so I think it's going to take reassessing and reevaluating what faith means. It's going to take new language. So I feel like a part of my own journey in the last year especially has been just a search for language that I can connect to when talking about God. So that poet I mentioned, Christian Wiman, has been an amazing resource for me. And there are other, whether they're musicians or artists, or just Christian thinkers that have made it seem plausible again, but I'm not by any means someone who always finds it easy to call myself a Christian or to want to align with this tradition. And yet, in the end, I know there's no better description for my worldview than to say that I am one. So I think for our generation, it's going to mean trying to find new language for things and learning to do some things differently while holding on to the traditions that are important and that are really essential in that have been handed down to us.
Yeah, if I can ask, and you know, feel free to say no, but the last year you said your views have changed a lot, or the way that you see things, and I'm wondering to what extent that you're engaging with the fashion world and thinking about these issues, has that affected your faith over the past several years? Can you put some words to that? I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's my trying to engage with the fashion world from a Christian perspective has actually been something that's given me a lot of hope, because it's something that I feel, I so strongly believe that if there is a God in the universe, that God cares about this industry, God cares about the people in this industry, and God cares about things, I think, to a greater degree than we often act as though that's true. I mean, we often act like, you know, we're sort of these spiritual beings trapped in bodies walking around on this earth that's eventually going to disappear. I don't really think that's definitely not descriptive of how I see the world at this point. I think things really matter. I think bodies really matter. I think we're embodied creatures, and therefore, like our interactions with clothing isn't just this sort of superficial thing that we're dealing with for, you know, 80 years while we're on this earth, and then once we're in the great unknown, it's not a part of our lives anymore. I mean, that's not the picture that we get from Revelation. That's not the picture that we get from the Bible overall. So I would actually say that my studies of and trying to learn more about fashion and be engaged in the industry have been encouraging to me in times when I have been struggling with other aspects of my faith, just because it's something that I love that I really do believe God cares so much about.
Very cool. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here, because this was something that you had mentioned in email conversations, that not only have you gone to Christian Fashion Week, but you've gone to something called Burning Man. And that seems like a very millennial thing. That's out there in the deserts in Nevada, where people without any electricity or cell phone connections kind of hang out for a couple days, and then they burn a big, huge effigy of something that looks like a person or something like that. You know, you with your eyes toward fashion and seeing how people adorn their bodies, and this obviously is not the New York runway. This is, you know, as far away as you can get from it. Tell us a little bit about your experience at Burning Man.
Yeah, well, one thing I'll do real quick is actually correct your misconception that it's a super millennial thing.
Okay. No, there's old hippies there too. Yeah, I know that.
So it was actually started in the, I think in the 70s, and the average age, they do a census every year, and the average age of burners is between 38 and 41. So me being there as a 20-something, I was definitely not like, oh, I'm the majority of people, although there definitely are a lot of young people there. But being at Burning Man and thinking about clothing was really, really fascinating. So it's a community that is, they have, you know, 10 different sort of tenets that they're thinking about all the time. And one of those is radical self-expression. And you definitely see that in how people are clothing themselves at Burning Man. And it was very, very bizarre in some ways. I mean, when I first got to the playa and was riding, everyone rides bikes around because it's this huge, huge area in the desert. And I was riding my bike through the center camp, and I seriously thought, like, I look like I'm on a Star Wars set. Like, people are in these bizarre things, and they have blinking lights, and, you know, massive, they're wearing fur, and they're wearing almost nothing, and they're wearing everything in between, and it's just this completely other sort of visual culture. But I ended up being just, more and more interested as the week went on, because another tenet of Burning Man's sort of community is the principle of decommodification. So nothing, once you get out into the desert, you're completely self-sufficient, and nothing is sold or bought except for ice and coffee, and you can't buy anything else. And they really, really encourage people to not bring branded things, and you can't, like, take pictures of you and your whatever branded shoes and then go back and put them on Instagram for your brand. Like, they shut all of that down pretty hardcore. So what results is people really going all out, being super, super creative in how they're adorning themselves, but it's not about any sort of corporation. It really is about people trying to explore something for themselves and engage in this specific community, which creates a really fun sort of attitude around clothing. People sort of go crazy, but there's no, you know, I'm going to put this on Instagram and hopefully this brand is going to, you know, repost it to their Instagram, or, you know, whatever the case may be, whatever people's motivations are for that kind of thing. You just don't see that at Burning Man, which I thought was really, really cool.
And what about the spiritual aspect? Did you pick up any kind of spiritual vibe? Was it a Christian vibe? Was it a, you know, pagan dancing around tree vibe? I mean, what kind of things did you see in that realm?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask, because I was actually there as a press person. So I was there writing a story and taking pictures for a story about two researchers from Wheaton College, which is my alma mater, and they're researching alternative spiritualities at Burning Man, and then also the Christians who are trying to reach these people who are experimenting with alternative spirituality. So it's definitely a spiritual place. People are very spiritually open at Burning Man in a way that they're not necessarily in what they call the default world, which means, you know, the rest of us during the rest of the year besides that one week in the desert. Mm-hmm. But it's a very sort of eclectic hodgepodge. So people won't necessarily be Buddhist or Hindu or Christian. They're sort of piecing together the pieces that they like from each of these different ways of seeing the world and crafting this, what one of the researchers I was working with called Christo-paganism. So a lot of them are coming from Judeo-Christian backgrounds, but then they're bringing in elements from these sort of diverse, different worldviews and crafting their own sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you do on your website is you focus mostly on women's fashion, but I'm a guy here, and you know, I'm not the most fashionable guy in the world. I've known to wear a nice suit every so often, but here's my big question. This I guess relates to Burning Man as well, and it's been a fashion trend that's kind of concerned me, but it's these Christian hipsters wearing beards. What's up with that? I mean, I'm somebody I've had a beard for about 25 years now, and I see all these, you know, young 20-somethings trying to do the hip, you know, Christian songs on stage, and I get kind of worried about them.
Well, you know what, Tony? That really means that you're the ultimate hipster, because hipsters are all about doing things before they were cool.
Yeah, I guess
so. Tell them, you're just trying to be like me.
I guess so. Somebody told me I brought a a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon home one time, and they said, that's a hipster beer. And I said, no, it's a cheap beer. What do you mean hipster beer? And that's where I learned about hipsterism. So, yeah, very interesting. So I guess I'm hip before my time. No, very good.
There you go.
Well, let me finish up with this question then. And one of the things that you're doing with your work, with your freelance journalism, and also your blog, Unwrinkling, is to bridge the divide between academia and the public when it comes to fashion theory. And I think that's really neat. I think you're doing a lot of cool stuff here. It'd be really neat to see you writing a book about your experiences and you know, coining that term fashion theology, or really at least popularizing it if you haven't coined it yourself. But explain to this old fuddy-duddy academic here why us academics should pay more attention to fashion and theology, and why this gap between the academic world and the fashion world and the lay community should be bridged.
Well, one thing that I really enjoyed about going to a liberal arts school is that I didn't study fashion in terms of it being my major, but I made every single class that I took about fashion. So I took an anthropology class. I used fashion as a way to study culture. I took a science class. I used fashion as a way to study pollution. I mean, it's connected in so many ways because it's such an intimate part of our culture. It's present in every single culture across the world, which means that it affects our economics, it affects our politics, it affects our art, it affects our religion, and it's interwoven into all of those things. So I think that's one reason that academics from a variety of disciplines should sort of give it the time of day. And on the other hand, I think as like wanting to bridge that gap for sort of the popular crowd too, I have seen academics who are actually paying attention. There's actually an academic journal called Fashion Theory that was started by Valerie Steele, who's at the FIT Museum in New York, the Fashion Institute of Technology, and she's bringing together academics from this great sort of array, talking about a huge range of different things, and that's been really cool to see. But what I want to see is that those theories and those ways of thinking about things actually being communicated to people who don't necessarily like to sit around reading theory on a Friday night, as someone like me might enjoy doing, and communicating those ideas to them in a way that they can digest and can inform their life in a meaningful way that they can really understand. So I think when academia isn't actually connected to real life, that's a problem. And then when real life or life outside of the ivory tower isn't connected to people who are paid to think about things and really come up with a lot of exciting ways of understanding and moving forward as a group of people, there really is a loss when there's a lack of connection there.
Well, I will give you a big amen to that, because that's what we're trying to do here on Research on Religion. And we share that with you on your blog, Unwrinkling, where you're bringing a lot of this stuff together. And I should also note that we are recording this on a Friday night, and you're very gracious to be spending your New York Friday night, which is like a hipster central, I guess, out there to be talking about fashion theory and fashion theology with me. So I want to thank you for being on the show. My guest today has been Whitney Bach. Whitney, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.